This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 1st, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A British medical group says Iraq's health system is worse today than before the war. Our correspondents in Baghdad report this is true for most basic services. And today is World AIDS Day. We kick off a special series looking at the state of the pandemic. Today we look at Latin America and Africa. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Jailed Fatah leader Marwan Barghouti has decided to run for the position of Palestinian president. His wife submitted the formal papers for her husband's candidacy to the Central Election Commission in Ramallah today. Adding to the electoral turmoil, Hamas has announced its intention to boycott the January 9th elections. If Hamas' tens of thousands of supporters abide by the boycott, it could undercut the legitimacy of the vote. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade has already endorsed former Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. But as Awad Duwabis reports from Ramallah, the addition of Barghouti as an independent candidate on the ballot may be a blow to Fatah.
This will be a major strike against Fatah itself, since already Fatah has chosen Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen, the former Prime Minister, to run for the presidency. And this means that Fatah might be divided after the death of Yasser Arafat. See, this means that Fatah is already divided into two camps, between the old guard, represented by Abu Mazen, and the young guard, represented by Marwan Barghouti.
Eight people were shot by Indonesian police today while celebrating Independence Day in West Papua. From Jakarta, Maggie Margiono.
Hundreds of people, most of them students, that they celebrated the 43rd Independent Day of West Papua in the capital of Indonesia's easternmost province, Jayapura. They demanded a democratic process to end Indonesia's rule on the island. Suddenly, hundreds of Indonesian police attacked them and shot the students. Eight people were injured by bullets, and some others were injured by stones and bottles. West Papua's December 1st Independent Day was proclaimed in 1961. The celebration has always been marred by repression by Indonesian authorities. From Jakarta, Maggie Margiono reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
In commemoration of World AIDS Day, a coalition of international activist groups rallied in front of the World Bank and IMF to protest policies they say impede the fight against AIDS. Jenny Johnson is in Washington, D.C.
The groups focused on the disproportionate impact of HIV/AIDS on women and girls throughout the world, while condemning the World Bank and IMF policies for developing countries. Vanita Gupta is a doctor from India.
Not only I think that they are obstructing the progress that people are trying to make, but I think that they are actually pushing poor people, especially women, towards these diseases.
The women cited policies such as the push for privatization of health and water services. Also targeted were the low inflation priorities that forced governments to limit their spending, which has reduced education programs. AIDS disproportionately affects women and girls in the U.S. as well, where African American women are at the highest risk of infection. Amira Woods of Foreign Policy in Focus said the spread of AIDS is an issue of impoverishment.
40% of children in the U.S. are living in poverty. And a large percentage of those are children from communities of color.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
We'll begin our three-day series commemorating World AIDS Day later in the newscast. Colombia's Congress has approved a bill allowing President Alvaro Uribe to run for an unprecedented second term. Nicole Carson reports from Bogota.
While the amendment still has to be approved by the Constitutional Court, Uribe stands a good chance at getting reelected in 2006. Amid Colombia's 40-year-old armed conflict, Uribe is admired by some for his tough stance against the guerrilla, but criticized by human rights groups for not clamping down on abuses and for negotiating with paramilitaries who have not upheld a ceasefire. Uribe has strong ties to President Bush, who promised more military aid for Colombia when he visited this Andean nation last week. From Bogota, this is Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Cuba has released five more opposition leaders from jail after they were arrested, tried, and given lengthy sentences last year for sedition. Our Havana correspondent, Joseph Muti, has more.
One of the most prominent of the 75 opposition members imprisoned 19 months ago after being accused of working with the United States to bring down the Cuban government was released Tuesday. Raul Rivero, along with Osvaldo Alfonso, were granted parole and taken to their homes. Three others were released on Monday. Rivero, who said that he had not been given any release conditions, is accused by Cuban authorities of taking money from U.S. sources in return for writing articles critical of the Cuban government. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. The new releases bring to 12 the number of freed prisoners from the original 75, most being released for health reasons. The Cuban government has made no official comment. For Free Speech Radio, in Havana, I'm Joseph Mutti.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The Pentagon announced today that an additional 1,500 troops will be sent to Iraq in light of the Iraqi elections. This will bring the total troop numbers deployed in Iraq to 150,000 troops. This comes as the Pentagon recently announced it will also be extending the tour of duty for currently deployed soldiers. Meanwhile, a British medical charity today said that Iraq's health system is in far worse condition than it was before the war. Doctors from the group MedAct conducted surveys with international aid groups and Iraqi health workers in September, which exposed the poor sanitation in many hospitals, the extreme shortages of drugs and qualified staff, and the large gaps in service for mothers and children. And as FSRN correspondents in Baghdad, Salam Talib and Dar Jamil, report, many such basic services are worse off today than before the war.
With electricity working only 2 out of every 6 hours, Baghdad is running on generators. An ongoing fuel crisis worsens as lines at gas stations stretch for miles. The crisis has raised the costs of everything, making life unbearable for Iraqis. Black market gasoline has risen 400%. Cooking propane, which used to cost 15 cents per tank, is now $7. Kerosene for heaters, which Iraqis used to pay 1 cent for 5 gallons, has risen 10,000%. Meanwhile, today another pipeline was sabotaged south of Baghdad, underscoring the fact that oil production in Iraq during the U.S. occupation has yet to exceed pre-war levels. In Fallujah, the military continues to claim that they are mopping up pockets of resistance and that most of the city is under their control. Residents inside the city are telling a different story.
The Mujahideen control Jubail and the south of Nazal district. They control Al-Askira, Julan, and the south of Al-Sunai.
Yesterday, one Marine was killed and 3 wounded in an attack from a house in Fallujah that the military thought had been cleared of insurgents. The resident of Fallujah.
They tried to bomb the fighters to scare them out of the city, but the fighters did not leave.
In Baghdad, a suicide car bomb detonated into a military patrol on the airport road, which is becoming a daily occurrence. And as often happens in Iraq, while witnesses said they watched soldiers pull dead bodies from military vehicles, the military stated that 5 soldiers were wounded, but none killed. At least 1,254 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq since last year's invasion. Over 9,000 U.S. troops have been wounded, 5,000 of them seriously. It is estimated that 15,000 troops have been evacuated from Iraq with, quote, non-combat injuries. November was the second deadliest month in Iraq for U.S. troops, with at least 134 killed, just one short of April when 135 were killed. Like countless refugees and aid workers are reporting, the military is continuing to use illegal weapons in Fallujah.
The Americans are using cluster bombs and the kind of bombs that make burns on the body. You can't treat it with water, but people are putting dust on them to put out the fires.
The U.S. ambassador of Iraq, John Negroponte, has announced that most of Iraq is safe and secure. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dar Jamil with Salam Talib in Baghdad, Iraq.
A self-appointed panel issued reform proposals to strengthen the role of the United Nations and to address worldwide issues such as the threat to security. Among those reforms are the expansion of the Security Council, a newly devised definition of terrorism, and the acceptance of preemptive strikes. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from the UN.
A 16-member panel issued proposals of reform to the UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan. It includes 101 proposals that would alter the makeup of the United Nations more than at any other time in its nearly 60-year history, and it will address the need for collective security of an increasingly borderless world. The members, representatives from 16 nations and its 95-page report, said the proposals would strengthen the UN and address today's world threats, such as terrorism, nuclear and biological weapons, both internal and interstate war, and economic issues, including poverty and AIDS. The spokesperson for the Secretary General said the chairman of the panel, Anand Panyalachun, is pleased with the panel's findings.
The 95-page report puts forward a new vision of collective security, one that addresses all of the major threats to international peace and security felt around the world.
They propose to expand the Security Council from its current 16-member status to 24 members in an effort to better world representation. And it would categorize nations into four regions with equal representation: Asia and the Pacific, Europe, Africa, and the Americas. But disagreements among the panel members brought about two different options. Columbia political science law professor and former advisor to Kofi Annan said that the disagreement among the panel members reflects the divisions that will take place among countries who would be vying for these new seats.
With regard to Africa, Egypt is making a claim. So is South Africa, perhaps Nigeria. Two seats are proposed. Which of those three would get those two seats? And similar issues arise around the world. So partly it's there isn't yet a consensus as to who deserves that new status. It is contentious.
The proposal also states that while following strict civil liberties and human rights rules, that the United Nations should take action against terrorists through intelligence sharing and law enforcement, and it should hold states accountable that promote or don't attempt to stop terrorists. In addition, a universal definition of terrorist should be decided upon, taking into account the Geneva Conventions and past UN resolutions on terrorism, but analyzing the new and increasing role of terrorism in world security. In addition, the panel affirms the right to preemptive strike, but should only be considered after five guidelines are met. The chairman of the panel will present the report to the General Assembly tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A Texas woman who was slated to be executed tonight was granted a stay just hours before her date with death by Texas Governor Rick Perry. This came after the Texas Parole Board recommended delaying the execution of Frances Newton. Newton would have been the first black woman in Texas to be executed by the state since the Civil War. Newton has maintained that she's innocent of killing her family in order to collect on their life insurance policies. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz has the latest.
Governor Rick Perry halted Frances Newton's execution shortly after 4 p.m. Central Time today. Perry spokesman Robert Black.
Today, Governor Rick Perry granted a 120-day reprieve for convicted killer Frances Elaine Newton. After a lengthy review of the trial transcript, appellate court rulings, and clemency proceedings, the governor saw no evidence of innocence. However, he is granting the additional time to allow the courts the opportunity to order a retesting of gunpowder residue on the skirt the defendant wore at the time of the murders, and of the gun used in the murders. Although this evidence was evaluated by the jury and appellate courts, new technology is available for testing the gunpowder residue. The governor added that every death penalty case is unique, and his decision is based on the specific issues in Newton's case.
Concerns about Newton's case relate to core problems with the Texas death penalty system, namely inadequate legal representation and a conviction based on evidence from the now discredited Houston Police Department crime lab. Newton says she last saw her family alive the evening of April 7, 1987. She says she returned home that night to find her husband Adrian, 7-year-old son Alton, and almost 2-year-old daughter Farah shot dead.
Went to answer the phone, and it was for my husband. I went to get him and looking for him, and when I turned and I went toward the couch, and he was on the couch, and he had been, I saw blood on him.
Newton was later convicted of killing her family. She's always denied she killed anybody. Her attorney, David Dow, hopes the governor will approve his request for 120 days to investigate evidence never examined that could prove her innocence.
Most prominently, the suggestion that her husband was in fact killed by drug dealers and he was heavily involved in drug enterprise. There was an anonymous tip to the police by a neighbor who saw a strange pickup truck in the driveway at the time that the murders were occurring. She wrote down the license plate number, and neither police nor any of Francis Newton's lawyers ever investigated that lead.
This didn't impress Jose Aliceta, the lone dissenter in the board's 5-1 vote to grant investigators time in Newton's case.
The courts have looked at that issue and they found it did not have merit.
Newton recalls what it was like to be represented by a man now viewed as one of the state's most incompetent defense attorneys.
Really made me feel like my time in jail wouldn't be long. And then when we got to trial and he hadn't interviewed any witnesses, hadn't talked to anybody, had barely had any contact with me, it was pretty frightening knowing that I would be going to trial with no investigation having been done.
And no investigation has been done in her case since then during her lengthy appeals process. Attorney David Dow says much of the state's evidence rests on ballistics testimony from the now widely discredited HPD crime lab.
That the actual data that underlay the testimony is not part of the trial record, so that we really don't have anything more than some ballistics examiner saying, oh yes, I've looked at the bullets and they're consistent with a bullet that could have been fired from the guns. We have nothing that would allow us to examine the credibility of his testimony.
Over the next 120 days, Dow will now conduct investigations into evidence in Newton's case. There is no guarantee new evidence will be granted a new court hearing. I'm Renee Feltz, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
With his resignation announcement, Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge will be leaving the department he helped create. The formation of the department encompasses many government functions, including border control and immigration. While the nation is involved in a debate over whether the country is safer because of the Homeland Security Department, Mitch Jeserich reports that human rights, civil libertarian and government watchdog groups are asking, safer for whom?
At a press conference announcing his resignation on Tuesday, Secretary of Homeland Security Department Tom Ridge says the monstrous task of combining 22 agencies under a single department has made the nation safer from terrorist attacks.
One could say that individual decisions that these men and women make out there at ports of entry have as much to do with the security of the country as any individual decisions we might make here at headquarters.
The formation of the Homeland Security Department engulfed the Immigration and Naturalization Services Agency. Since its formation, the department has been aggressively investigating possible immigration violators and has been prioritizing such investigations towards people it considers a potential security threat. Though the department denies it, critics contend the investigations are predominantly geared towards Muslims and Arabs. Arsalan Iftikhar is the legal director of the Council on American Islamic Relations.
If we look at the way that INS and now ICE has gone about enforcing the violation of civil immigration laws, our community feels as though we have been disparately targeted due in fact to, the issue that we constitute a very, very small percentage of visa violators in this nation.
Secretary Ridge will likely be remembered for the color-coded national terror alerts. When the alert level was raised to orange, the second highest level, the frequency that Middle Easterners and immigrants were investigated by either the FBI or Homeland Security Department also rose. Timothy Edgar is the legislative counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union.
When the alert levels were raised, it seemed to be at least somewhat coordinated with FBI efforts. FBI, of course, outside of the Department of Homeland Security, but they went through a series of voluntary interview programs, which really are very intimidating FBI sweeps that are based on a suspicion of people just because of their ethnicity and national background, not based on any individual suspicion.
Edgar does credit both Secretary Ridge and the department for the creation of civil liberties and privacy officers inside the department, who he says were helpful in communicating such concerns to high-level officials. But Edgar says the ACLU has been in other battles with the department over such issues as the biometric system being initiated in airports and tracking the movement of immigrants within the country. The group, Human Rights First, is calling on President Bush to nominate a new secretary who will ensure the protection of refugees is a higher priority within the Department of Homeland Security. Eleanor Acer is the director of Refugee Protection Program of Human Rights First.
The new Department of Homeland Security was created over a year ago. It was, from the perspective of immigrants and from refugees in particular, sort of a bureaucratic nightmare. The old INS was abolished and separated into three separate bureaus in different parts of the department, and refugees basically got lost in the shuffle. They fall between the cracks, particularly when they interact with the immigration enforcement bureaus, the bureaus that detain and deport them.
Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
Green and Libertarian Party presidential candidates have presented New Mexico's state officials with the requisite deposit to seek a statewide recount of the vote from New Mexico's presidential contest. President Bush won that state by 5,988 votes. A similar request was today also filed by the Greens in Nevada. Meanwhile, Ohio is preparing for a statewide recount of the 2004 presidential votes, with allegations being raised that the elections may have been comprised by discrepancies, voter suppression, and outright fraud. Evan Davis has more.
The Board of Elections in Delaware County, Ohio, engaged the county prosecutor to petition the courts to issue an injunction against the recount of the votes in that county on the basis that the Green and Libertarian candidates who filed for a recount in all of Ohio's 88 counties received too few votes to gain anything if the votes were reexamined. David Yost is the county prosecutor representing the Delaware County Board of Electors.
The bottom line is that the two folks that we know of that are going to ask for a recount have no hope of changing the outcome of this election. In particular, the Green Party candidate, Mr. Cobb, had precisely one vote. So we're in the awkward position of a person who got precisely one vote out of more than 80,000 who wants a recount at the public expense.
The Green Party and the Voting Rights Coalition filed a lawsuit this week to overturn the temporary injunction halting the recount in Delaware County, and the Kerry campaign then joined that action and have asked for the case to be moved to a federal court. Jesse Jackson, along with 500 demonstrators, urged support for the Green and Libertarian Party's recount efforts and called for a thorough investigation of the election discrepancies in all of Ohio's 88 counties. Jackson also met with attorneys who are preparing to contest Ohio's electoral results in a lawsuit to be filed before the Ohio Supreme Court later this week. Arnebeck's suit will also cite a growing body of evidence which reveals widespread disenfranchisement of voters throughout Ohio in what both he and Reverend Jackson say appears to be a pattern of deliberately targeting African-American voters in the heavily urban counties where the black vote favored Kerry by over 85%.
This is not about the Kerry campaign per se. This really is about Med Gavis. It's about Van Lou Hamer. It's about Sandra Goodman Cheney. It's about Mandela 27 years in jail. It's about the irregularities here of such, we don't have the moral authority to speak to what's happening in Ukraine. It's a big issue here, the integrity of our vote.
Another close race for the Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice seat paralleled the presidential contest in the exit polls, yet in the 13 southern Ohio counties, the Democratic candidate for that office received a greater margin of votes than Senator John Kerry. This, says Arnebeck, suggests that there may have been wholesale shifting of votes from Kerry to Bush after the votes were cast.
All this civil rights violation was a red herring and intended to stimulate the public interest groups and civil rights organizations to hone in on this horrendous attack on the rights of white black voters. They thought that's what we would go after. The clock would run out. We wouldn't be able to prove our case. The real fraud occurred in this switching of votes in southern Ohio. That's our present view of the evidence.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
As we reported in the headlines, today is World AIDS Day, and FSRN kicks off a special series looking at the state of the pandemic across the world. More than 2 million people are now living with HIV/AIDS in Latin America and the Caribbean, including an estimated 250,000 people who contracted the disease in the last year, as FSRN's Matt Golin reports from Buenos Aires.
The countries with higher levels of AIDS in the region are Haiti, Guatemala, Dominican Republic, and Honduras. In these countries, it's no longer confined to what was used to call vulnerable populations, such as homosexual men, sex workers, drug users, and so on. It's now threatening the general population. The director of the WestPED Foundation, Pedro Cant.
Argentina, Brazil, Costa Rica, Chile, Cuba are the countries that provide medical treatment through a comprehensive program. The rest of the countries are in an extreme situation. We have many people who don't know they are infected by HIV. The most vulnerable people are young women and poor people.
In Haiti, AIDS has been the principal cause of adults' death since the early 90s. In 2001, more than 30,000 individuals have died as a result of AIDS, and more than 200,000 children have lost one or both parents. Honduras is the epicenter of the epidemic in Central America, where nearly 50% of HIV cases were reported in the region. According to an annual report released last week by the World Health Organization, there are currently 130,000 individuals living with HIV in Argentina, and 20% of them are women, much less than the average in Latin America. Lorena Buzarra, doctor of patients with HIV.
The most affected groups are women in their reproductive years. The sudden increase was because prevention measures were not taken to avoid the contamination of women. Physiologically, women have a much higher risk of infection during sex than men do. As of yet, a vaccine does not exist, and the only thing we have is a primary prevention tactic, and that does not exist either.
Women and girls also know less than men about how HIV is transmitted, often because this information is denied to them. Poverty, ignorance, and discrimination are the deepest-rooted problems of all. In many poor countries, people suffer unequal access to education and medical care, which thus places them at risk. Still rapidly growing, the epidemic is reversing development gains, robbing millions of their lives, widening the gap between rich and poor, and undermining social and economic security. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin and Zula Warken from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
AIDS also continues to ravage the African continent. In 2003, 2.2 million Africans died of AIDS, while an estimated 3 million contracted the HIV virus. This brought the total number of people living with the virus on the continent to about 25 million, according to UNAIDS. Depending on access to effective antiretroviral medication, these people will die in the next 10 years, joining the 19.2 million Africans already claimed by the pandemic since the early 80s. Still today, it can be said that the disease is in the south, while the medication is in the north. This year, France gave medical licenses to allow the production of generic medicines against AIDS to all African countries. From Senegal, Njaga Sek reports.
Many believe Africans would live longer with the disease if antiretroviral medication were available. Today, the disease is in the south and the medications are in the north. To reverse the tendency, France will give to all African countries free medication licenses to make generic medicines against HIV/AIDS. French Minister of Health, Philippe Doust Blasi, came to Senegal last week to launch the program.
I've personally worked on, first, authorizing group licenses for several molecules to guarantee the availability of the three therapy combination in one tablet, because that's what the Global South needs. Secondly, I'll authorize the agreement so that African governments benefit from raw pharmaceutical materials.
To date, 30,000 Senegalese died of AIDS, and currently some 80,000 are HIV infected. Senegal's 1.4 HIV prevalence rate is seen as a positive example in sub-Saharan Africa, resulting from efforts made by governing bodies, religious leaders, and populations. 2,700 HIV-infected people are under treatment in 2004. They will be 3,000 in 2005. With the free medical licenses, it will be easier for African countries to succeed the 3x5 plan, 3 million HIV-infected people under ARV by 2005. Senegalese Minister of Health Issambe Samb explains.
France is now assisting us in production. It's giving us patents to produce antiretroviral medicines. They are generic medicines which are antiretroviral, but also against malaria. We think this project has come in due time. It will allow us to solve the problem of the accessibility of medicines geographically and financially.
The UNAIDS report claims that some 18 million of 37 million HIV-infected are women. In Senegal, the number of infected women has quadrupled, whereas that of men hasn't even doubled. In Senegal, for FSIN, I'm Njaga Sek.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.